A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about that Nordic prison model we touched on recently. The one where inmates get keys to their own cells and the whole thing sounds less like punishment and more like a strange taxpayer-funded retreat. His real question cuts deeper, though. If the defense of these prisons is that they teach life skills people were missing, why aren't we teaching those skills before someone commits a crime? Is there actually an established causal pathway from life skill deficits to criminal offending? And have any countries tried to fix this at the source instead of downstream?
This is one of those questions where the data is actually way ahead of the policy, and it's been ahead of the policy for decades. The frustrating thing is, we've known about this link since at least the 1980s, and yet here we are still having the conversation like it's speculative.
Let's unpack it properly. Before we even get to prevention, what's the actual evidence that lacking life skills leads to criminal behavior? Because I can imagine a skeptic saying plenty of people are bad with money, or terrible at conflict resolution, and they don't rob anyone.
Right, and that's the right question to start with. The most robust evidence comes from the Cambridge Study in Delinquent Development. David Farrington and his team tracked 411 boys from South London starting in 1961, following them all the way to age 40. What they found was that low verbal IQ measured at age 8 to 10, poor impulse control, and lack of conflict resolution skills at that same age were significant predictors of criminal convictions by age 40. And I mean significant. These weren't marginal correlations.
We're talking about things you can see in an 8-year-old that predict who's going to end up in the system 30 years later.
And then there's the theoretical framework that actually explains why this happens. Robert Ross and his colleagues developed what they called the Cognitive Behavioral Deficit Hypothesis back in 1985. The idea is that some individuals lack specific cognitive skills, emotional regulation, problem solving, social perspective, taking, what they called means-end reasoning, which is basically the ability to think through the steps to achieve a goal without breaking the law. When you lack those skills, you're more likely to react impulsively to situations in ways that end up being criminal.
Means and reasoning. So it's not that someone decides, I'm going to be a criminal. It's that when they want something, or when they're in a conflict, they literally can't map out a legal path from point A to point B.
That's the hypothesis, and it holds up pretty well. Think about it in concrete terms. If you've never learned how to budget, how to understand interest rates, how to plan financially, you're more likely to end up in debt. Debt creates desperation. Desperation leads to theft or fraud. That's pathway one. Poor conflict resolution skills. Someone insults you, you feel disrespected, and your entire toolkit for responding is either violence or nothing. You don't have the skills to de-escalate, to negotiate, to walk away and process the emotion later. So a verbal argument escalates, and suddenly you've committed assault.
Which is a reactive crime, not a planned one. That fits the impulsivity piece.
Pathway three is employment skills. If you don't know how to write a resume, how to show up on time, how to handle a job interview, how to manage workplace relationships, you're going to struggle with employment. Chronic unemployment is one of the strongest predictors of property crime. And pathway four is the mental health angle. Untreated conditions like ADHD or depression impair executive function. So someone might actually know the skills but be unable to deploy them consistently.
That last one is important because Daniel specifically mentioned people with mental illness who lack basic life skills and feel too embarrassed to ask for help. The embarrassment barrier is real.
It's enormously real. And it creates this vicious cycle. You're struggling. You're ashamed to admit you're struggling. The struggle gets worse, and by the time anyone notices, you've already done something that got you arrested. The Ross and Fabiano framework from 85 explicitly addressed this. They found that many offenders weren't skill deficient in the sense of never having been taught, but rather they couldn't access those skills under stress or in emotionally charged situations.
It's not just a teaching problem. It's a deployment problem.
which is why their intervention, the Reasoning and Rehabilitation Program, or R&R, was designed as a 35-session cognitive behavioral program that didn't just teach skills but actually had people practice using them in simulated high-stress scenarios. They taught self-control, social perspective, taking, critical thinking, creative problem-solving. And the results were striking. Meta-analyses showed about a 30% reduction in recidivism.
30% from a 35-session program. That's a lot of return on a modest investment.
That was in the 1980s. But here's where it gets really interesting. The Perry Preschool Project. This ran from 1962 to 1967 in Ypsilanti, Michigan. They took low-income 3- and 4-year-olds, provided intensive life skills education. We're talking about things like planning, cooperation, conflict resolution, basic cognitive skills, and then followed those kids for 40 years.
3- and 4-year-olds, that's upstream.
That's as upstream as it gets. The 40-year follow-up, published by Schweinhardt and colleagues in 2005, found that the Perry Preschool Group had 46% lower arrest rates for violent crimes and 33% fewer felony arrests compared to the control group. And the economic return was $7.16 for every dollar invested through reduced crime costs, higher earnings, and lower welfare expenditures.
7 to 1. That's the kind of number that should make a fiscal conservative sit up and pay attention.
It should, and yet somehow it doesn't always. Let me give you another one. The Hawaii Hope Probation Program, launched in 2004 by Judge Stephen Alm. Instead of incarcerating people for probation violations, Hope provided immediate, predictable sanctions, short jail stays of a few days, combined with life skills training and drug treatment. The evaluation by Hawken and Kleiman in 2009 showed a 55% reduction in recidivism compared to standard probation, with cost savings of $5,000 per participant per year.
55% is enormous. What made the sanctions piece work?
In a normal probation system, you might violate the term 6 times before anything happens, and then suddenly you're facing revocation and years in prison. Under Hope, the first violation gets you a weekend in jail. It turns out that certainty of consequences matters more than severity. Combine that with actual skills training and you get those numbers.
We've got a Canadian program from the 80s, an American preschool program from the 60s, and a Hawaiian probation program from the 2000s, all showing significant reductions. The evidence isn't new, and it's not from one country. So what's the disconnect? Why aren't these programs everywhere?
You've hit on what I think is the central tension of this entire episode. Let me give you the numbers that explain it. The United States spends roughly $80 billion annually on incarceration, about $5 billion. That's according to the Vera Institute of Justice. So we're spending 16 times more on downstream punishment than upstream prevention, even though the prevention programs show better results per dollar.
A prison is a building you can cut a ribbon on.
A life skills program in a community center is politically invisible. You can't hold a press conference in front of a kid learning to budget. You can't point to a teenager practicing conflict resolution and say, "I built that." But a new prison. That's a jobs program, a construction contract, a photo opportunity. It's a classic collective action problem. Everyone benefits from prevention, but no individual politician gets credit for it.
The ribbon-cutting problem. So let's talk about the countries that have actually tried to solve this upstream. Finland comes up a lot in these conversations.
Finland's Schools on the Move program is one of the better examples. It integrates physical activity, social skills training, and emotional regulation into the regular school day. It's not a separate program, it's embedded in how schools operate. Between 2000 and 2020, Finland's youth crime rate dropped about 40%. Now, you can't attribute all of that to Schools on the Move. There were other factors, including broader social policy changes. But it was part of a deliberate upstream strategy.
Finland's broader approach is worth noting here because it connects back to the Nordic prison model. The humane prisons aren't the starting point. They're downstream of a system that already invests heavily in preventing skill deficits from forming.
That's the point that gets lost in most coverage. Norway spends about $15,000 per student per year on education, compared to roughly $12,000 in the US. They have universal health care, which means mental health conditions get treated before they become crises. The prison conditions that look luxurious from the outside are actually a reflection of a society that's already done the upstream work. The prison is designed for the small fraction of people who still end up offending, despite all that.
When an American looks at a Norwegian prison and says, "This is a hotel," They're missing that Norway isn't starting from the same baseline.
And even within that system, Norway has something called the import model. Prisoners retain access to community services while incarcerated. They get health care from the same system as everyone else, education from the same system, employment support from the same system. The idea is that prison shouldn't be a separate universe. It should be a temporary interruption in an otherwise normal life. That's downstream treatment designed to mimic upstream conditions.
Which raises the question Daniel was really asking. Could we just do this before someone offends?
In the 1990s and early 2000s, they implemented something called the Crime Prevention through Social Development approach. The federal government funded community-based life skills programs in high-crime neighborhoods, everything from parenting support to youth conflict resolution to financial literacy. Evaluations showed 20-30% reductions in youth crime in the targeted areas, but funding was cut after a change in government.
Of course it was.
The pattern is depressingly consistent. Prevention programs work, they get evaluated, they show results, then there's an election, and the new government cuts them because the benefits won't show up until after the next election cycle. Meanwhile, the prison budget keeps growing because the consequences of cutting that are immediate and visible.
The UK's Troubled Families Program, is that still running?
Launched in 2012, targeted 120,000 families with multiple risk factors, crime, unemployment, mental health issues, truancy. They provided intensive life skills, coaching, financial management support, parenting classes. The Ministry of Housing Evaluation showed a 33% reduction in offending among children in treated families. The program has survived multiple government changes, which is unusual, but its funding has been cut and restored several times.
33% reduction among children. That's intergenerational impact. You're not just helping the parents. You're changing the trajectory for the next generation.
Which is exactly what the Perry Preschool Project found 40 years later. These programs have compounding effects. The kid who learns emotional regulation at age 4 is less likely to drop out of school, more likely to get a job, more likely to be a stable parent, and their own kids benefit from that stability. It's not just a linear return, it's exponential.
Let me try to synthesize this. The empirical case seems clear. There are established causal pathways from specific skill deficits to specific types of crime. Financial illiteracy leads to debt and desperation, which leads to theft and fraud. Poor conflict resolution leads to escalation and assault. Lack of employment skills leads to unemployment and property crime. Untreated mental illness impairs executive function and leads to reactive offending across categories.
The programs that address these deficits upstream. Perry Preschool, R&R, Hope, Schools on the Move, Troubled Families, all show significant reductions in offending, typically in the 30-55% range, with strong returns on investment.
If the evidence is this solid, and it's been solid for decades, what's actually stopping us from shifting resources upstream?
Part of it is the misconception problem. There's a persistent belief that people who commit crimes are fundamentally different from normal people, that they're just bad actors making bad choices. The data doesn't support that. Many offenders have identifiable, addressable skill deficits. They're not a different species. They're people who didn't learn things that most of us take for granted.
The other misconception is that prevention is expensive luxury spending. But when Perry Preschool returns $7 for every dollar, it's not spending, it's investment.
The Nordic prison misconception cuts both ways. Critics say Norwegian prisons coddle criminals, but the reality is they're designed to reduce recidivism through skill building and normalization. Inmates still lose their freedom. They just gain life skills while they're inside. The recidivism rate in Norway is about 20% within 2 years, compared to roughly 76% within 5 years in the U.S. That's not because Norwegians are inherently less criminal. It's because the system is designed to produce different outcomes.
76% versus 20%. That's not a marginal difference. That's a system failure versus a system that mostly works.
Here's the thing about that U.S. number. It's from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and it tracks rearrest within 5 years. The Norwegian number tracks reconviction within 2 years, so they're not even measuring exactly the same thing, but the gap is so large that it holds up under any reasonable comparison.
What can someone actually do with this information? If a listener is convinced that upstream prevention makes more sense than downstream incarceration, what's the practical step?
One concrete thing. Ask your local elected officials what percentage of the criminal justice budget goes to prevention versus incarceration. In most U.S. jurisdictions, it's less than 5%. Just asking the question puts it on their radar. And if you want to support programs that are already doing this work, organizations like Boys and Girls Clubs of America run life skills programs in communities that need them most. Local reentry programs often do skills training that could have been done upstream but wasn't.
There's also the social impact bond model. Private investors fund prevention programs, and the government pays them back from the savings in reduced incarceration costs. It's a way to fund prevention without waiting for a budget line item.
Right. The Peterborough Social Impact Bond in the UK was one of the first, funding prisoner rehabilitation with returns tied to reduced reoffending. The model works, but it's still tiny compared to the scale of the problem.
Let me pose the open question that I think this episode leaves us with. If we redirected 10% of prison spending to upstream life skills programs, just 10%, would we see a 50% reduction in incarceration within a generation?
The data suggests yes, or something close to it. The Perry preschool numbers, the Hope numbers, the troubled families numbers, they all point in that direction. But the political will isn't there, because the benefits accrue over decades and the costs of shifting resources are immediate.
There's another dimension to this that makes it even more urgent. As AI and automation eliminate low-skill jobs, the link between skill deficits and crime is likely to intensify. If you can't compete in a labor market that increasingly demands cognitive and social skills, the pathways to legitimate income narrow. Upstream prevention becomes not just humane, but economically necessary.
That's the part that keeps me up at night. We're looking at a future where the skill floor for employment keeps rising, and we're still not systematically teaching those skills to the people who need them most. The gap is going to widen, and the downstream consequences are going to get more expensive.
The weirdest prompt of all might be this. What if the best prison is the one that never needs to be built?
That's the paradox in a nutshell. We've spent decades optimizing incarceration, making prisons more humane, more rehabilitative, more Nordic, when the evidence has been telling us all along that the most effective intervention happens in a preschool classroom or a community center, not a cell.
The Norwegian model isn't the goal. It's a symptom of a society that invested upstream first and built prisons for the remainder. If you try to copy the prisons without copying the upstream investment, you get the appearance of humanity without the outcomes.
You get the perverse incentive Daniel flagged, a prison that sounds appealing enough that it distorts the whole conversation. The solution isn't to make prisons worse, it's to make them less necessary.
Which brings us back to the core finding from all these studies. The skills that keep people out of prison. Emotional regulation, financial literacy, conflict resolution, perspective taking, means and reasoning are teachable. We know how to teach them. We've known for 40 years. The question isn't whether prevention works. It's whether we're willing to pay for it now instead of paying much more for incarceration later.
That's a political question, not a technical one. The technical case is closed.
For the listener who wants to engage with this, support community-based life skills programs in your area. Ask your elected officials about the prevention to incarceration ratio in your local budget. Look into social impact bonds as a funding mechanism. And if you know someone who's struggling with the exact skill gaps we've been talking about, financial management, conflict resolution, job readiness, the embarrassment barrier is real, and sometimes the most effective intervention is just letting someone know that struggling with these things is normal and fixable.
The data is on your side if you want to make this case. Perry Preschool, $7.16 return per dollar invested. Happy Probation, 55% recidivism reduction, $5,000 saved per participant per year. Troubled Families, 33% reduction in youth offending. This isn't wishful thinking. It's documented, replicated, peer-reviewed fact.
Yet we spend 16 times more on incarceration than prevention. That ratio is a choice, not a necessity.
Every dollar spent on a prison cell is a dollar not spent on a preschool classroom. Every year someone spends incarcerated for a crime that might have been prevented is a year of lost productivity, broken families, and compounding social costs. The math isn't complicated, the politics are.
The best prison is the one that never needs to be built. And the best time to build the alternative was 40 years ago. The second best time is now.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1900s, a prominent German historian named Jakob Philipp Fallmerayer argued that the Byzantine court ceremonial practice of proskynesis, full prostration before the emperor, was directly descended from ancient Aleutian whale hunting rituals based on what he claimed were shared patterns of bodily submission before superior forces. The theory was taken seriously for nearly two decades before being completely debunked.
Prostration is whale hunting technique. That's certainly a connection someone made.
I have so many questions about how he got from the Aleutians to Byzantium, but I suspect the answers would only raise more questions.
This has been my Weird Prompts. If you want more episodes like this one, and we've got 200 of them, head to myweirdprompts.com or find us on Spotify. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.